we had really great nuns that taught us at St. Joseph Academy in Baton Rouge. And I wanted to be a teacher. They were full of faith, humor. They were excellent teachers. And they really challenged our minds to think and to look into things. And this is in the 50s. I joined the Sisters of St. Joseph in 1957. And it was a time when, in the 40s and 50s, probably earlier than that, young women looking at their future as Catholics was you got married or you became a nun. And I just kind of knew that I didn't want to be, I grew up in a very happy family. My mother and father were lovely, a lovely couple, loved each other and children, and maybe was happy. But I loved what the nuns were offering. It was the only way a woman could, you knew you'd be educated, you knew you'd be part of a community, you knew you'd be given time for a spiritual life and to be able to pursue a spiritual life, like time for a retreat, workshops, meeting other spiritual people. And I wanted that. And so I joined when I was just 18. And what I tell in the memoir is how religious life, when I joined, you wore a full, complete habit. You could never leave the convent without another sister. You could never spend the night outside the convent except in another convent. You couldn't even visit your family home again. They had to come and see you every month. And but then the Second Vatican Council happened in the Catholic Church. And that was 62 to 65. And that is as big for Catholics as the Reformation was with Martin Luther for Protestants. Yeah. Because it was the first time that there was a council in the church simply to update the church to be able to relate better to the modern world. It was the first time you had a council that was not to condemn some heresy of some other religion or heresies within the Catholic Church. It was an outward-looking council that Pope John the 23rd opened. He said, we got to open the windows. We got to get fresh air in the church. You know, and it brought in great things, and nobody embraced it more than nuns, than the women in the Catholic Church who were sisters.
Yeah.
Because it brought us back to the Gospels, that you didn't just study a catechism for what the Gospel message was, but you went to the Scriptures, and we could study the Scriptures. It was the first time I had courses on the Gospels and the Epistles and the New Testament, the Old Testament, the whole thing of the Bible. And it also, when I entered the community, the way that you became holy was you prayed and you practiced blind obedience. You gave up your intellect and your will to just simply obey whatever the superior told you to do. That came out of a very long history of women being passive in marriages. It was pretty much the same way. It took a long time, even in the United States, for women to be able to vote, sign legal documents, because it came out of a whole patriarchal thing, which is still pretty much in many ways in place in the Catholic Church, also in our society. I mean, the Me Too movement is very recent, but you've had male dominance over women for most of the history of the world, actually. And so our minds were opened, and that then began to affirm that this, as Pope John the 23rd and as the council said, mostly when people talk about the church, they mean the hierarchy. They're talking about some bishop. They said the church made me mad. They did this. But the council said the people are the church. And so that by baptism, everybody's called to holiness. And you don't have this hierarchy of holiness, like bishops are the holiest, then priests, then nuns, and finally, the poor laity. And so we took it seriously, and it began then to affirm that we could develop our selfhood. What just blind obedience is, what do you see? And what's the Holy Spirit sparking you to do? And that is the trail then, as I woke up with that. It led me to, by being challenged by the community and the discussions we were having, that it wasn't enough to be charitable to everybody around us out there in the suburbs, but to get involved on the margins. As Pope Francis has often called the church, it should be like a field hospital where people are hurt and wounded. And so that is what I awakened to. It's called the Lightning Chapter in River of Fire, where suddenly I heard a talk and I got it, that when Jesus said, blessed are the poor, he didn't just mean one day you'll have a great reward in heaven, but just accept your poverty as God's will, but that it was the right for poor people to struggle against poverty, to be able to better their lives and not simply to accept it as God's will. And I realized when I heard that talk, I didn't even know any poor people, and I lived in New Orleans, where we had 10 major housing projects. I'd never been to any of them, and that was the awakening moment that led me to move into the St. Thomas housing projects. That's toward the end of the book, and then from there, one day, got that invitation to write a man on death row, and it fit in with what I was learning about social justice, and I wrote the person. His name was Patrick Saunier. 2.5 years later, he was executed, and that's what launched me into the whole activism of waking up the American people and traveling and writing books to so that we can abolish the death penalty.
That lightning chapter, as you say, intersects with your own ignorance, if I can use that word, to your own privilege.
Yeah, ignorance, that was kind of cushioned by privilege, see?
Yeah.
Because if my whole concept of following the way of Christ was to be charitable to people around me, but I didn't reach out to the margin, I didn't question the systems so that people, through racism, when I grew up in the Jim Crow era in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Black people in Sacred Heart Church couldn't even sit with us. And I never questioned it. And that's what culture does. It's like, well, honey, it's better for us. It's better for the races to be separate. They like to be with their own people, and we like to be with ours. And without understanding what harm and hurt happened to families, Black families, who when they traveled couldn't even stop at a restaurant for their family or go to the bathroom. And so that privilege of only being with people like me, that being charitable to people around me was never going to be enough. The Gospels are far more radical than that. And that was the waking up that happened to me.
And I think it's important to note what age this happened at. You're not 22.
Yeah.
You're how old are you when this happens?
That was, what, about 40, 42, 43?
Right.
Yeah. But you know what, though, Laura?
Yeah.
Anytime we wake up is a good time to wake up. Because we don't say, oh, wow, look at all the time I wasted. Why wouldn't I wake? The important thing is when we do wake up and have a spiritual insight to a purpose in our life is that we act on it. That's what's really important. And that's what I tell about then. What steps I took, moving into the St. Thomas Housing Project, being with the people. And then African-American people became my teachers. I didn't know about institutional racism. I knew people could be prejudiced, but I didn't know how you could have a whole system. For example, even linguistic racism. When you look at words, and words have power, and you look at the definition of white, Lily White, pure, always good. Cowboy movie, the guy with the white hat was always a good guy. Black, black ball, blacklist. Cowboy, black hat, bad guy. That's even just in the language. And then as I got involved with the death penalty, I was going to see how it just infiltrated the whole criminal justice system. The starkest thing for the death penalty is that when you look at the over 1,000 people we've executed, and the over 2,000 people we have on death row, 8 out of every 10 of them are there because they killed a white victim. Because when it's a citizen who's prized and who has status, then their death causes outrage and the ultimate penalty will be sought. But if life is negligible, then there's not going to be a huge effort. And I learned that in St. Thomas, where somebody, it was black on black crime, and then with mothers at a support group, where one of the mothers said, I've had 2 of my sons killed in 6 months, and the police never even investigated the killings. So you have how life is valued in a society. And so when you have a penal system, and of course the death penalty is the apex of the penal system in the United States. It's the worst thing that can happen to a person is that the government decides that you're not worthy of living and that they're going to kill you. But the whole imprisonment, massive imprisonment of people of color throughout Louisiana is the worst, with the worst incarcerator more than anyone. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but the New York Times has come out with the 1619 Project. Have you heard of that?
I have not.
To mark the 400 years in which slavery has made its mark in the United States.
I have seen that, yeah.
Have you seen it?
I have, yeah.
And then there's also a great book, Stamped from the Beginning, where you had Jeff Davis, who later became the president of the Confederacy, making a speech in the Senate that black people were stamped from the beginning as inferior, meant to be the servants of white people. And that has infiltrated our country, and it skewed our Constitution so that we didn't even include slaves as persons. And in fact, when you read the 13th Amendment, I learned this when I wrote Dead Man Walking. When you read the 13th Amendment that abolished slavery, it makes an exception, except for those who are incarcerated. And that was the way, the penal system became the way, that white plantation owners, when all these workers are freed, how are they going to get their workers? And so they put in these harsh black codes in the legislatures, the penal system, that if a black man was seen, the big catch-all net that you can always catch people in was called loitering. And then you put them in jail. Yeah, they serve their time. Then when it's time to get out, they say, oh, well, you owe us for lodging and you owe us for food, so we're going to send you to this work camp. And it was pervasive. And they even found a mass grave outside of Birmingham near a mine where they just would shuttle people right over from the jail to work in the mine where they continued to be imprisoned. And it was another form of slavery. So I'm just learning about all this myself. And so you just see that as a white person, you had all these privileges and benefits, and I was totally unconscious of it. I just thought it was because I was a good nun, I was educated, I worked hard, and I kind of, I don't know if I ever used the word deserve what I got, but I figured it would be coming to me if I did the right things, you know, and didn't know what it would mean to have to work against race for everything, what school I went to, whether or not I could get a bank loan, what neighborhood I could live in. Just never had to deal with any of that.
Yeah. Let me, as you speak, one of the things that comes to mind here in South Dakota is we recently have been talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women. And we talk about crimes that are not investigated at the same rate as other crimes, and the role of Native women historically and the effects of colonization. And my question for you is, once you start having an understanding of that history, it can feel overwhelming. What's next?
Yeah.
How do you turn that ship around beyond just, now I'm aware of something that I didn't know before that's not my lived experience, but now I have an understanding that this is the lived experience for so many people, and people ask, what do I do about it?
Right. You know, that's the fire part of the title of my book, River Fire.
Yeah.
And with that quote from St. Bonaventure, ask not for understanding, ask for the fire. Fire means that we learn something or know something, and we know we have to do something. It sparks us to some kind of action. So you look at it, and it's what happened to me with the death penalty, of course. It was in the early 80s. We had 8 executions in 8.5 weeks, and I was just learning. I go, what do you do? This is a wave, a tidal wave that was coming across the United States. But you probably asked the most important question right there, because it's as long as you just look around at all the things that are wrong, you do get overwhelmed. But the minute you reach out to do an action, to join some group, to write a letter, to participate, that's wrong. I'm going to do something about it, no matter how small it is. My experience was that it freed me up. Action frees us. And then, of course, it leads us right into a community of people, because we can't be lone rangers in the quest for justice. You don't last long. And then one simple step, I wrote a letter to Man on Death Row. I began to meet people in the community that were working for justice in prison. I began to meet lawyers who were taking the cases. I began to meet Amnesty International members who were working for human rights. So once you get on the path, or you start following a current, and you get involved, you're doing something. You're not just studying something, and you're not just wringing your hands and lamenting. You're doing something. That is what frees us up. And then that one action leads to other actions, and it enmeshes us then in a community of people without whom we will not make it very long.
South Dakota is scheduled our 5th execution since 2007 for the month of November. And the last execution we had was actually just last year, October of 2018. And we could talk about this for hours, and people who know your work and who have read your work. But one of the things that I was reading that you said really stuck with me, which was how many people are affected by an execution beyond the people who are in the room. And just as a journalist, I can tell you, I didn't have to witness it. I didn't have to cover it. I only had to host a conversation about the execution and the crime, and it was the worst day I've ever had at work.
Oh, yes.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, just tell me a little bit about that. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is an important thing to talk about, because we think, well, the family of the one who's executed is directly affected, of course. The children of the person, sometimes the spouse, the parents, our son, and it's so shameful. I've known siblings that move out of the state because they have a brother on death row. But what we're also finding out more and more is how it is affecting guards and the wardens that have had to do the killing. And I'm going to give you an example, like in Louisiana, where we've had so many, one on top of the other. We haven't had an execution in Louisiana for 17 years. One consensual execution where somebody gave up their appeals. But it's kind of died off. And so you got to ask the question, why? What's changed? Well, one thing is that there has been an impact on society, because when we got into this and started doing it, we didn't think we'd ever have innocent people on death row. And now I think the latest number is 168, where we realized we made another mistake, that we thought we'd have a foolproof system with the appeals and all, that we'd never make a mistake. So now, as a society, we're much more conscious. Yeah, you know, we've been making a lot of mistakes, which impacts juries. So when they're going to decide on life or death, and now juries have to be given more information before they would send a note to a judge saying, if we don't give the death penalty, and it had been a terrible, violent crime, they weren't to protect society, what will the sentence be? Will he be out in a few years? And there would be no answer. Now they have to be told two alternatives, which is a life sentence that the person's going to get. And that takes care of the safety issue, that most people just want to protect society. And so then you have the guards, wardens speaking out. You have jurors who have been hurt by these decisions. They didn't feel they got the true knowledge that they needed. They only find out afterwards when the appeals comes and finds out, well, God, that was actually an innocent person, but we weren't given the information at trial. And learning how imperfect the system is, and all these things, I think, are contributing to us putting the death penalty down. Now, you have a particular constellation there in South Dakota. For an execution to happen, you have to have a governor who's willing to go along with it and say it's the law. And meanwhile, right in another state over in California, you have a governor that's instituted a moratorium on all executions. So individuals with individual consciences and individual consciousness show up in this constellation. So for it to the execution to go through, you got to have the governor in place. You have to have a prosecutor who sought the death penalty and got it, because it is up to prosecutors. They never have to seek a death penalty. And then so much, there are so many variables about what makes them do that. Who was the victim? Who cares? Was it a white woman in a house? The race of the victim. And then what you're saying about indigenous women, look how long that's been going on, that they're being raped and they're being murdered. But as the head of the Department of Corrections told me in Louisiana one time, he said, sister, don't get me wrong, but this thing is, if you're a nobody and you're not important in society, then you're the one that they go for the death penalty. And they'll never seek the death penalty if you kill. And he told me that. He was the head of the Department of Corrections. So we are a very imperfect society. And that's putting it mildly. We've been racist from the beginning, the legacy of the racism that came out of slavery. We're much more prone to fear brown skin and dark skinned people than we are. We see that with immigration. We just see the fierce language used about immigrants, and even those seeking asylum have walked 2,000 miles. And they're called rapists and drug dealers and gang leaders. And just the language, look at it. And so all of that plays a part. And then it boils down to, there are 2% of the counties of the entire United States where there are prosecutors still seeking the death penalty. And so it's like lightning hitting. It's arbitrary, capricious, by its very nature, because the discretion is left up to individual prosecutors whether or not to seek the death penalty.
Do you feel there is a tipping point? As you've watched,
Well, we can see it happening. We are shutting the death penalty down. Texas used to get 48 death sentences a year, and now it's down to 2 or 0 over the last several years. So what's happening? Why aren't prosecutors seeking it? Well, it has impacted a number of prosecutors that you can think you get the right one and they turn out to be innocent, with seeing all the mistakes. And then public opinion. It used to be people, we were made to be so afraid of these people that there are certain murderers who by their character and their nature are just so evil and so bad, you can't even put them in prison because they'll kill other inmates or they'll kill guards. The only thing we can do is execute them. And so when you really ramp up fear, you can do almost anything to anybody. And then it's behind prison walls. The whole reason I wrote Dead Man Walking and why I stay on the road and why I got this goal is going from state to state to talk to people. Eliminate that. I don't want to make myself out to be a victim. I mean, if you know what I mean,
right.
Is to wake people up and to bring them close to what it really means to execute a human being. And that was at the heart of my dialogue with Pope John Paul II in the Catholic Church. And I said, Your Holiness, I hear Catholics who say they're pro-life, they're against abortion, but they're for the death penalty. And when I'm walking with a man to execution, and he's shackled hand and foot, and he's surrounded by guards, and they're going to walk him down this hall and strap him down and kill him, and he kind of turns to me and just says, Sister, please pray that God holds up my legs while I make this walk. Where is the dignity in taking a person, rendering them defenseless, and killing them? We have a way to protect society, which is prison. Why are we imitating the killing and doing it in the most premeditated way where a person's been rendered absolutely defenseless? And that's what getting to some of the wardens who've had to officiate at the execution, where like Rob McAndrews in Florida, he said, I'm learning to run a good prison. I saw it as an honorable profession. And I'm in that execution chamber, and I'm the first trigger. I'm the one that nods my head to the executioner, and this person strapped down in front of me is absolutely defenseless. And I participated in the killing of a defenseless human being. And I know that's wrong. And I don't know if he's still giving talks publicly, but when he did, he said, I'll be in therapy the rest of my life. Even when you look at the Geneva Convention about the limits of what you can do with prisoners of war, one of the really strict rules they always had from the beginning was you can't render a prisoner defenseless and take them out and shoot them because they don't have any defense. And that's what triggered the change. And don't get me wrong, I'm not the only one that was part of that dialogue. We had people all over the place participating in the dialogue, and I finally bumped into a pope or two in the dialogue. But that was the essence, because the traditional teaching of most Christian churches was that you allowed the state to take life to protect society. But once you had a way of protecting society, you don't need to do the death penalty anymore. And now that you have more and more people coming forth, just think how they're being harmed by it morally. Moral hurt. We have more and more reason to put it down. And there is no difference between states that have life imprisonment and states that have executions in the rate of violence. There's no noticeable advantage for a state being able to execute. Look at South Dakota and North Dakota, side by side. One of you has the death penalty, one of you doesn't.
Tell me what your message to Pope Francis has been regarding other injustices that still remain and need to be faced by the Catholic Church and, you know, and beyond, by society.
Well, the last chapter, or it's in the appendix of River of Fire, was my letter to Pope Francis about the need for women to be able to participate fully in the life of the Catholic Church. And I said to him, you know, when you have an all-male environment setting policies and are always the ones who are the preachers, always the ones who are the spokesperson, it gets unhealthy. We need women's wisdom, their experience at the table when we're making policy and we're looking at the moral issues of our day. And the fact that women are excluded, and I said to him, I said, you know, I preached all over the United States and in Europe, Australia, but I can't in my own Catholic Church. I can't even read the gospel at Mass. Canon law prescribes that only males can read the gospel and only males can preach. And I said, so we're deprived of women's wisdom in being able to preach. So you can see the first beginning steps, and I wanted to help move that current in the river along by appealing to the Pope that it's a deep wound in the church not to allow women to participate. And I said, so many, it's also a reason why young women are not keen to join the Catholic Church, because they don't see themselves being fully respected. So We're always, you know, one of the things Vatican II said was that the church is always going to be a pilgrim church. We're always going to be on our way. So we look in our history, there was a time we endorsed slavery. We changed that. There's been a long time that we upheld the death penalty. We changed that. On August 2nd, 2018, the teaching was officially changed within the Catholic Catechism. The next area, I believe, of where there's dialogue and where the people of the church recognize from lived experience of things that will need to change are women in the church, for sure. And then hopefully down the road also respect for gay people and that they are fully human and cannot be called that somehow they're defective and that they can't receive the sacraments of the church or they can't. So that's underway too. The teaching still doesn't acknowledge that. And you can go in churches where gay people don't feel welcome. But you look at the currents in the river. And so by calling the church the pilgrim church, it means we're always going to be on the way. And the way things change, the way Jesus talked about the gospel, it's saying to each of us, the kingdom of heaven is within you, and that the Holy Spirit is in each of us. And so each of us can have insight. Each of us can have experience. Each of us then can see something and say, hey, that's wrong. That needs to change. And then we raise our voices, and that's how the change happens.